Extract number 1. Read the questions.
A decade ago, English writer Peter Ackroyd came out with an unusual biography, not of a person, but of a city, the city of London. And in the course of his research, Ackroyd realized that a lot of what happened in London took place underground. Peter Ackroyd spoke to us about it from our studio in London.
Almost as soon as I'd finished my study of London, I became interested in and fascinated by the history of the city which lay beneath it. It's almost as large and as complicated as the city above ground, and in fact, in some senses, the workings of the underground city determine the pattern of life on the surface above.
Certainly the most prominent feature of London underground is actually the subway system, which is the world's oldest, opened in 1863.
Yes, the pioneer, the innovator, the one who inspired the building of the underground, Charles Pearson, was actually born in the 18th century. He was born in the same week that Marie Antoinette was executed. Mm. So you can see the longevity of the scheme. When the underground was finally finished in the 1860s, it could have been used by Charles Dickens, Charles Darwin. Oscar Wilde used to use it when he commuted to work as the editor of a ladies' periodical. So it is a very old system.
The early trains, you write, were, of course, steam trains, identical essentially to above-ground trains, except they were underground. It must have become very smoky inside.
Yes, it became very, what we would now describe as unhygienic, I suppose. Mm. It was full of smoke and soot and dust. It was essentially like taking a steam locomotive and putting it in a confined space, so you can imagine the amount of discomfort it caused. People fainted on the platforms. It became quite common for people to have to be taken up into the air to recover. It was altogether an unpleasant experience, and many travellers described it as if they were going into the hell.
There's an amazing photograph in the book. It's of people sleeping on the escalators inside of a tube station.
Yes, that was during the Second World War when thousands of people would buy a ticket at the end of the day, bring sandwiches or even beds and even deck chairs and settle down on the platforms in order to spend the night there. It was not a particularly agreeable experience because of the proximity of so many thousands of people, but they believed it to be a necessary one.
Whole government departments moved underground at the time. There was a newspaper that was made available to people underground at the time.
Yes, there were newspapers, libraries, various refreshment rooms. It was another city which grew up a time of danger.
When you walk along the streets of London now, are you constantly imagining what is beneath your feet?
Yes, I think of it in certain parts of London. There's a area of London not so far from where we are now, which houses beneath the surface a huge underground city that was to be used in times of nuclear attack, for example. There were several miles of railway, there were rooms, bedrooms, studios, conference rooms, all of them just 100 feet or so beneath the surface. And that has never been used. It remains empty to this day. But whenever I walk over that part of London, I feel very strongly the presence of this space beneath me.
Nobody goes in there.
And nobody goes. It was once an official secret, of course, but now it's simply deserted and abandoned.
Peter Ackroyd, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, listen again.
A decade ago, English writer Peter Ackroyd came out with an unusual biography, not of a person, but of a city, the city of London. And in the course of his research, Ackroyd realized that a lot of what happened in London took place underground. Peter Ackroyd spoke to us about it from our studio in London.
Almost as soon as I'd finished my study of London, I became interested in and fascinated by the history of the city which lay beneath it. It's almost as large and as complicated as the city above ground, and in fact, in some senses, the workings of the underground city determine the pattern of life on the surface above.
Certainly the most prominent feature of London underground is actually the subway system, which is the world's oldest, opened in 1863.
Yes, the pioneer, the innovator, the one who inspired the building of the underground, Charles Pearson, was actually born in the 18th century. He was born in the same week that Marie Antoinette was executed. Mm. So you can see the longevity of the scheme. When the underground was finally finished in 1860s, it could have been used by Charles Dickens, Charles Darwin. Oscar Wilde used to use it when he commuted to work as the editor of a ladies' periodical. So it is a very old system.
The early trains, you write, were, of course, steam trains, identical, essentially, to above-ground trains, except they were underground. It must have become very smoky inside.
Yes, it became very, what we would now describe as unhygienic, I suppose. Mm. It was full of smoke and soot and dust. It was essentially like taking a steam locomotive and putting it in a confined space, so you can imagine the amount of discomfort it caused. People fainted on the platforms. It became quite common for people to have to be taken up into the air to recover. It was altogether an unpleasant experience, and many travellers described it as if they were going into the hell.
There's an amazing photograph in the book. It's of people sleeping on the escalators inside of a tube station.
Yes, that was during the Second World War when thousands of people would buy a ticket at the end of the day, bring sandwiches or even beds and even deck chairs, and settle down on the platforms in order to spend the night there. It was not a particularly agreeable experience because of the proximity of so many thousands of people, but they believed it to be a necessary one.
Whole government departments moved underground. At the time, there was a newspaper that was made available to people underground at the time.
Yes, there were newspapers, libraries, various refreshment rooms. It was another city which grew up a time of danger.
When you walk along the streets of London now, are you constantly imagining what is beneath your feet?
Yes, I think of it in certain parts of London. There's a area of London not so far from where we are now, which houses beneath the surface, a huge underground city that was to be used in times of nuclear attack, for example. There were several miles of railway, there were rooms, bedrooms, studios, conference rooms, all of them just 100 feet or so beneath the surface. And that has never been used. It remains empty to this day. But whenever I walk over that part of London, I feel very strongly the presence of this space beneath me.
Nobody goes in there.
And nobody goes. It was once an official secret, of course, but now it's simply deserted and abandoned.
Peter Ackroyd, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Extract number 2. Read the questions.
You used to express a desire to read Moby Dick. Has this wish been fulfilled?
Yes, I read Moby Dick while I was making the movie Love and Death. I filmed in Budapest, and when I came back from work each night, there was absolutely nothing to do in Budapest. So I would come back to my hotel and read Moby Dick, and I finished it, started and finished it, while I was shooting Love and Death in Budapest, and liked it very, very much. But I never would have thought I would have loved anything at all that remotely revolved around whaling.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you are more of a musician than a singer, but when you are in the shower or in the car alone or doing karaoke, what one song do you like to just belt out?
I can sing in the shower, and my repertoire is limitless. I mean, I can sing anything in the shower. I sing all the jazz and pop tunes, all the Cole Porter tunes, in the shower. Outside of the shower, I start to have some problems with reality.
Speaking as a young neurotic person, has being neurotic in life done more good or more harm in your experience?
Well, it's interesting. People tend to think that I'm neurotic, and this, I feel, is a testimony to my acting ability. Over the years, I've played the neurotic, and I played it so well, I think. I'm not a good actor, but that I can do. And I played that one little thing that I can do well, that is a neurotic character, so effectively that people tend to think I'm neurotic in my life, when in fact, the truth of the matter is, if you looked at my entire life, you'd find that I'm not really very neurotic. I'm very structured, normal. I've been a very disciplined worker. I have my jazz orchestra that I requires practice and discipline, and I play with. And a neurotic personality would have trouble with that.
You've worked with everyone, but has anyone ever said, no thanks, I'll pass?
Many people have. There is a myth that all I do is call up any actor or actress and they drop whatever they're doing and work with me. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I don't like to name names here, but there have been actors and actresses that have passed because the money was not enough, passed because they didn't like the script that I sent them. So offered Sean Penn 3 movies before he did Sweet and Low Down. I've offered other people, you know, that I have no problem with that at all. You could turn down my movies a dozen times, and if I have a part that's good for you, I'll always offer it to you and hope for the best.
Do you have a dream project, a script sitting somewhere waiting to be made into a film, just waiting for the right producer?
Now, listen again.
You used to express a desire to read Moby Dick. Has this wish been fulfilled?
Yes, I read Moby Dick while I was making the movie Love and Death. I filmed in Budapest, and when I came back from work each night, there was absolutely nothing to do in Budapest. So I would come back to my hotel and read Moby Dick, and I finished it, started and finished it, while I was shooting Love and Death in Budapest, and liked it very, very much. But I never would have thought I would have loved anything at all that remotely revolved around whaling.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you are more of a musician than a singer. But when you are in the shower, or in the car alone, or doing karaoke, what one song do you like to just belt out?
I can sing in the shower, and my repertoire is limitless. I mean, I can sing anything in the shower. I sing all the jazz and pop tunes, all the Cole Porter tunes, in the shower. Outside of the shower, I start to have some problems with reality.
Speaking as a young, neurotic person, has being neurotic in life done more good or more harm in your experience?
Well, it's interesting. People tend to think that I'm neurotic. And this, I feel, is a testimony to my acting ability. Over the years, I've played the neurotic, and I played it so well, I think. I'm not a good actor, but that I can do. And I played that one little thing that I can do well, that is a neurotic character, so effectively that people tend to think I'm neurotic in my life, when in fact, the truth of the matter is, if you looked at my entire life, you'd find that I'm not really very neurotic. I'm very structured, normal. I've been a very disciplined worker. I have my jazz orchestra that requires practice and discipline, and I play with. And a neurotic personality would have trouble with that.
You've worked with everyone, but has anyone ever said, no thanks, I'll pass?
Many people have. There is a myth that all I do is call up any actor or actress and they drop whatever they're doing and work with me. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I don't like to name names here, but there have been actors and actresses that have passed because the money was not enough, passed because they didn't like the script that I sent them. So offered Sean Penn 3 movies before he did Sweet and Low Down. I've offered other people, you know, that I have no problem with that at all. You could turn down my movies a dozen times, and if I have a part that's good for you, I'll always offer it to you and hope for the best.
Do you have a dream project, a script sitting somewhere waiting to be made into a film, just waiting for the right producer?
Extract number 3. Read the questions.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about back pain now because it afflicts a whole lot of people. About 1 in 4 adults in the U.S. have experienced some form of it. Pain medication is usually the first thing people turn to for relief, but new research says you might want to strike a yoga pose before you reach for the pills.
Back pain can come on all at once. Floretta Francis remembers waking up one morning with pain. Francis started taking ibuprofen several times a day. When she went to see her doctor, she was recruited to participate in a study to see if yoga could be an effective way to ease the pain. Francis was very skeptical. She thought of yoga as exercise for fit people, not a treatment for back pain. When she walked into the first class after a hectic day of work and a long commute, this is what greeted her.
Now, listen again.
We're going to talk about back pain now because it afflicts a whole lot of people. About 1 in 4 adults in the U.S. have experienced some form of it. Pain medication is usually the first thing people turn to for relief, but new research says you might want to strike a yoga pose before you reach for the pills.
Back pain can come on all at once. Floretta Francis remembers waking up one morning with pain. Francis started taking ibuprofen several times a day. When she went to see her doctor, she was recruited to participate in a study to see if yoga could be an effective way to ease the pain. Francis was very skeptical. She thought of yoga as exercise for fit people, not a treatment for back pain. When she walked into the first class after a hectic day of work and a long commute, this is what greeted her.
That is the end of part 1.